lovely drive through this morning. Actually, the weather was fantastic. Could you turn with me to Colossians chapter 1, please? Colossians chapter 1. It won't have escaped you that there is a general election coming. I believe we're in the penultimate week. The political commentators are in a frenzy. There's been all sorts of excitement. Who's actually going to be in charge? Who's going to be Prime Minister? Will there be deals? Will there be backroom deals? I suspect everything will change, and all these things that people said they won't do, they will end up doing, because they'll get a sniff of power, and they'll probably sell their soul to get into power. And it's a very interesting thing. I don't usually pay a huge amount of attention to politics. One of my colleagues, who's a surgeon, has given up surgery for a time to try and stand for the SNP. So if some people who find that colleague slightly awkward are in a slight quandary, because they don't know whether to vote for them, because then they'd never have to work with them again, which in one hand is a positive thing, but some of the people that are concerned about this would not be what you would call SNP supporters, so they don't know, they're faced with a moral dilemma. Do they vote SNP and they hope they never have to work with a surgeon again, or do they not vote SNP and this person might get in? So it's a dilemma for some people, so it's quite entertaining. But what has struck me is that what most people do say is that the trust in politicians has been eroded, and that people do not trust politicians, and yet they will stand on the telly and they will say, you need to trust me. Trust me that I can do this. Trust me that I won't go back in my word. Trust me that I can make money out of nothing in the money tree that governments obviously have access to, and I can save the NHS, and I can save this, and I can save that, and I won't tax anybody. And, in the first debate, I don't know if any of you watched the debate, Ed Miliband had obviously been schooled by his advisors to continually look at the camera and say, if I'm Prime Minister, you can trust me, I know what I'm doing. And basically everybody's looking at him and saying, you don't know what you're doing. None of you really know what you're doing, and no, we don't trust you. And so I've been thinking a lot about that in the context, and so I want to come to a passage that will be very familiar to you. Because the reality is, who do you trust in this day and age? That is a key point. Who do you trust? Trust is something that has been continually eroded in all sorts of things, and people do struggle to find someone to trust now, to look out to for someone that may well rescue them, someone that they can rely on. And I would suggest to you that if you're going to trust someone, then that person has to show that they're trustworthy, and that person has to show that they can actually have control over the situations that we need to put trust in. You see, ultimately, I don't believe politicians have control of very much. But I do believe God has control of everything. And so the question is, who do you trust? Do you trust a man or a woman who might become Prime Minister or leader? Or do you actually trust the one who holds all things in his hands? So we're going to look at this morning, and we'll start from verse 9, though the main focus will be 15 through to 20. The reason I'm starting at verse 9 is, in the original languages, verse 9 through to the end of verse 23 is all one sentence. It's all one block. And so 9 through to 14 actually gives the context for the verses that we'll be looking at. For this reason, since the day we heard about you, we have not stopped praying for you. We continually ask God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all the wisdom and understanding that the Spirit gives, so that you may well live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience, and giving joyful thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light. For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. Verses 15 through to 20 have been classified as some of the most important verses about the person of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. Some people have said it was an early hymn, some people have said it was a poem. I don't think any of that particularly matters. What does matter is that this was written probably about 30 to 40 years after Jesus lived. Now, we know historically there was a person called Jesus. Occasionally, some people try and say there wasn't anybody called Jesus, but, you know, the weight of historical evidence is that there was actually a person called Jesus, that he was crucified, that he had a group of disciples, and a church was founded. These historical facts are without refute. What is interesting about this is that this book, written by someone called Paul, Paul was a Jew. And Paul was a very zealot and religious Jew. He was very keen in keeping the law, the commandments, etc. And yet he writes this about someone 30 years after his death. Paul would be fully aware that there was this person called Jesus Christ who was crucified. Now, crucifixion at that time was appalling. If you were a Roman citizen, you were never to be crucified. Such an appalling death it was. To a Jew, anyone that was crucified was cursed, because in the Old Testament there was a statement that said anyone who hangs on a tree is cursed. And yet what is quite incredible, 30 years after the death of this person called Jesus Christ, this passage is written about the same person by a Jew. So something clearly had happened. There had been something recognised about this person that was completely different from all other people that had ever lived, such that only 30 years after his death, a passage like this about a man who had been crucified is written. And what's quite interesting is that this, to me, is like a CV. You know how you sometimes have to fill in CVs? I'm supposed to update my CV every year for revalidation purposes to show that I'm a good chap and I'm being a good doctor. My CV hasn't changed in 5 years because my CV was done for my consultant interview, and yes, there's one or two extra things, but I've not actually been trying to improve my CV because I already have the job. But I have to sort of constantly update it, and I hate it. I've always hated it. You have to try and say things about yourself that you blatantly know are not exactly accurate. I mean, all your qualifications are that, but you just say how wonderful a chap you are, and you never get angry, and you never have any problems, and you never make mistakes, which is complete rubbish, obviously. But people, there's obviously this kind of unwritten rule that people accept that CVs are very often a work of fiction. But when you think about a CV, you talk about your previous experience, you talk about your current experience, and you talk about your future aims. And if you look at this passage, there's past, there's present, and there's future. There's things that have been done, there's things that are being done in the present, and there's things that will be done in the future. And I would suggest to you that this is one of the best CVs ever written. This is a CV that is without parallel. And so Paul, as he writes this letter to this little church in Colossae, in verses 9 through to 14, he essentially prays that they would grow to know God better, and as they grow to know God better, they would develop wisdom and understanding about who God is and the work of Christ, and from this they would live lives worthy of the person that had called them. And he says, you've been brought from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, you've been changed, and you've been changed by the forgiveness of God, which has been purchased through the blood and redemption of his Son. And then he turns around and introduces the Son. And he introduces these verses. And here's the thing. If you are going to trust someone, if someone is going to rescue you, as Paul says in verse 13, for he has rescued us, then you need somebody that can physically rescue you. You need someone that can actually save you. You need someone that you can trust. Because someone can say they can rescue you. Someone can say they're trustworthy, but unless their actions, unless their abilities, unless their life actually demonstrate that, then they are not worth putting our trust or our faith in. And I think there's three things that this passage shows. It shows that Jesus is supreme in creation, Jesus is supreme in the church, and ultimately Jesus will be supreme in the new creation. And in these five verses, Christ is presented as the agent of God in the whole range of God's purpose towards the human race. From the creation of the human race, to redemption of the human race, to the final consummation of God's salvation's plan with a new heaven and a new earth. So first of all, I believe Jesus is supreme in all of creation. And the first verse in verse 15, the first phrase says, the Son is the image of the invisible God. I'm sure you've heard lots of people say, if only I would see God, I would believe. If only I could see him, if only he would make himself known, then I would believe him. The interesting thing is that the person that wrote this book, Paul, and another part of the Bible, clearly states that he saw Jesus. He saw the risen Jesus. Okay? So, if somebody says this and writes it down, they're either a liar, or they believe what they saw. There's not really anything in the middle. And if you believe these documents, which have more evidence than any other ancient document, that what we have today is what was actually written down, then there is a sense in which the people that wrote this, the people that said we saw Jesus alive, were people that other people actually spoke to. So Paul's statement is not just a theological, theoretical thing. It's actually one that has come from experience. The Apostle John says in one of his letters, John had been one of the disciples that had spent three and a half years with Jesus before his crucifixion, says this, "This is the one we heard, the one we saw, the one we touched, and the one they saw alive." John says this in another part of the Bible. He says, "No one has ever seen God, but the one and only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known." There's a story in Jesus' life when Philip, one of his friends, says to him, "Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us." And Jesus answers, "Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been among you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father?" I love the honesty of the Bible. If you're going to make up a holy book, you don't put mistakes and flaws in. You make people look great. You don't make people look bad. You know, there's honesty in the Bible. You see people, warts and all. Richard Dawkins, a very famous atheist, has said, "Well, if God wants me to know him, he should just reveal himself to me." But the interesting thing is, I believe God has shown himself. God has shown himself in the person of his Son. Jesus came, he was a historical person who lived and walked on this earth. And we now have documents that reflect that life, that have been first-hand accounts of the things he said and the things he did. And then we have documents written about after his life, about explanations of what he said and what he did, and expansions of that theology. So I believe God literally has come down and shown himself. And this is what it says, the Son is the image of the invisible God. And the Greek word is icon, and it assumes a prototype, something that's exactly copied. It's also the word that was used for the master plate that would imprint a coin. And we know that there's another part of the Bible that says this, in the past God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. After he had provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. So I would suggest to you that God has revealed himself to this world in many ways. He's revealed himself to the world through creation, and we'll talk about that in a little minute. And then in the first part of the Bible, the Old Testament, there was people came and spoke what they felt God had told them to say. And then finally he came in the person of his Son. Jesus is the explanation of who God is. If you want to see God, God has shown us himself in the person of his Son. How Jesus speaks, how he acts, how he lives, reveals the character of God. So we see humility, because God comes down. You laid aside your majesty. The God who makes the universe comes and learns how to speak and to walk. Imagine. The one who created muscles has to learn to use muscles. The God of the universe learns to work in wood and make furniture, because he was a carpenter. He's the one who heals the blind and the sick. He's the one who frees people from madness. He's the one who says to a woman who's been condemned by the Pharisees, and he calls them out on it, and he says, well, I don't condemn you either. Go and sin no more. He's the one who speaks to people that no one else speaks to. He's the one who speaks to a woman who's been ostracized from her community at a well. He's the one who cries at the tomb of his friend who has died. He's the one who washes the feet of his disciples. He's the one who has his feet washed by a lady of disrepute. He's the one who remains quiet as people betray him. He's the one who goes to the cross and sacrifices himself. So people want to see God. People want to make all sorts of caricatures about God. But God is saying, this is what I am like. I have revealed myself in the person of my Son. In Isaiah 52, the prophet says this, see my servant, and he's speaking about Jesus, see my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. And what God is saying there, way before Jesus was born, is when Jesus comes, I want you to look at him. I want you to see him. Do you see my Son? This is how I am. This is me revealing myself in the ultimate way. Jesus, as he comes and begins our rescue, is displaying the very heart of God in all that he does. So he's the image of God, but he's also the firstborn over creation. Now, firstborn doesn't mean a created being, but firstborn is here in the sense of position and power. In Psalm 89 it says this, and I will appoint him to be my firstborn, the most exalted of the kings of the earth. I will maintain my love to him forever, and my covenant with him will never fail. I will establish his line forever, his throne as long as the heavens endure. And these ideas of image and firstborn in the New Testament are picking up what's been introduced in the Old Testament. That's why I've read from Isaiah. That's why I've read from Psalm 89. So to people that knew the Old Testament, to Jewish people, the idea of Jesus being the image and the firstborn and the wisdom of God would not be sort of been plucked out of the air. They would understand this was a reflection of things that had been foretold. In Proverbs chapter 8, wisdom is given a personality. And it talks about wisdom being there when the world was made. And what Paul is saying here is, Christ is the ultimate wisdom of God. He is the ultimate knowledge of God. He is the ultimate outworking of God's character and who God is. So Paul, in verses 9 through to 14, has prayed for knowledge. And he's prayed that they would grow in wisdom. So what he's actually saying is, he's praying that they would understand Jesus more. And by understanding Jesus more, they would understand their salvation more, and they would understand the work of God more. So, he's the image of God, he's the firstborn of creation, but he's also the agent of creation. And it says in verse 16, for in him all things were created. All things. All things. Whether seen or unseen, whether visible and invisible, all things were created, from the smallest molecules of the cell to the largest planets to the universe. John chapter 1 says this, "He was with God in the beginning, and through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made." And what Paul is saying here is, he is before everything. He is supreme over everything, whether it is man-made wisdom, or man-made philosophy, or other religious systems. He is superior because he was before all things, and all things were made through him. And God knows what he is doing. And we see that Jesus has power over creation in the way he lives his life. He heals people that have been born blind. You cannot do that medically yet. If somebody is born blind, they cannot be made to see. Because as you are born, you can't see very well, and your brain has to make billions of connections between your eye and your brain so that you can see. So the man that Jesus says, and he rubs his eyes, and the man says, "I can see." It doesn't make sense. Because literally in an instant, billions of electrical connections have been made in that man's brain so that he can see. He stands in a boat and calms the waves to the point that fishermen who had been on the sea all their lives say, "Who is this guy that even the wind and the waves obey him?" You see, if somebody's going to be your rescuer, he needs to display authority, doesn't he? And he displays authority over creation in the way he deals with it. He can do what he wants with creation. Whether people are sick or well, whether there is storms, with food, he can do what he wants with food and feed people. And what Paul is saying here is, the one who is supreme is the one who should be worshipped, not the actual creation. There's a whole sort of philosophy in our world where we worship creation. And people marvel at the wonder of creation. And creation is an incredible thing. But they don't look beyond that. They don't look beyond that to see the one who was involved in this creation. And so he's the image of the invisible God. He's the firstborn. He's the agent of creation. And then it says, "And in him all things hold together." All things hold together. He sustains all things. Our universe is poorly understood, and they reckon about 90 to 95% of our universe is this thing called dark matter. And it's called dark matter because the scientists can't see it and they can't measure it. But they've worked out that the physics of the universe needs something holding it together, or it doesn't make sense. And one night Dad and I were sitting watching a program, and this guy was talking about dark matter, and we turned to each other and said, "And in him all things hold together." You see, but people won't look at the one who holds all things together. They will try and find explanations outside of that, rather than believing something that has been simply written down 2,000 years ago by a guy who didn't have the first clue about astrophysics, our gravitational forces in the universe, and yet Paul says he holds all things together. You'll remember a little while ago there was a huge amount of excitement about a big particle accelerator in Europe that had found the God particle, a particle that had only been theoretically understood. And if you try and read the physics of the God particle, my word, it's very complicated. But essentially, I think what it boils down to is, if it wasn't for the God particle, we would explode. Because the God particle is something that allows other particles to obtain mass. And so even at the level of things that can't even be seen, there are forces holding things together. And if those forces are not apparent, we would explode. I can't even begin to comprehend that degree of power. Next to him, we are absolutely nothing. If he wasn't in charge today, the world would explode. The universe would collapse. None of us would be here. we would all just explode, because we would not be being held together by his power and his authority. And he has total authority over creation and everything that he has made and yet to be made. Now, if it stops there, if you think about that as a God, that is just frightening. Can you imagine dealing with a being like that? My children are discovering the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, and we listen to them in the car. And there's a fantastic line in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe when Aslan, who is an image of Christ, and Lucy says, he sounds a bit terrifying. And Mr. Beaver says, he is. But he is good. You see, the one who has all this authority and all this control is the one who says he's the father who will go after a lost son. And he's the shepherd who will go after a lost sheep. And he's the woman who will look for the lost coin. So yes, he is all-powerful and he is overwhelming and beyond our comprehension, but he is good. The next thing we have is this, that he is supreme in the church. And it seems a bit strange to go from the heights of the cosmos to talk about all this astrophysics, all these things going on, planets spinning, suns, the whole shebang. And Paul then says he's the head of the church. Is Paul changing the subject? No. What he's saying is the one who makes the cosmos is the one who generates this new community, this new people. He is supreme in the church, and we see again similar sort of imagery to his imagery in creation. He's the head, he's the beginning, and he's the firstborn. He's the one that starts it. Paul is linking the author of the universe to this little group of people sitting here in this church in Colossae. And he's linking it to this church here, or the church I'm part of, that we sit here because the one who created the cosmos and the one who holds the cosmos together has brought this community together and has called people to himself and has revealed himself to them, and they have come to know him as their Lord and the one who saves them. So Paul is telling them that they are now a new creation of God through the power of his Son, a new people living in a new kingdom sphere. The power and agent that made the universe is the same power and agent that's revealed himself to them and has rescued them and brought them into his kingdom. But if they're going to be a new humanity, a new creation, then they have to have new life. And so not only is he firstborn over the old humanity in that he was involved in creation, but he's now firstborn over the new humanity. Because from the position of death to life, he is the one that has been killed, but has been raised to life. He's the one that faced death down, and because he faced death down, we can now be alive. In Ephesians 2, Paul says this, "But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved, and God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus. Because of him we are made alive spiritually. We can be made new. We can be reborn into his kingdom." See, without him there is no church. There is no rescue. There is no redemption. There is no new humanity. That is why he is supreme over every other world religion. Because there is no other world religion that offers rescue and redemption outside of humanity. All other religions are glorified self-help, self-righteousness, doing what you can to earn favour with God. That's what they all are. If you break them down, that's what they all are. It's self-help, make yourself better. But here we read that we are rescued from the dominion of darkness and brought into the kingdom of light by ourselves? No, but by the work of his Son, who is supreme in everything. So he is supreme in creation, and he demonstrates his power over creation when he heals and all the rest of it, but he is also supreme over the new creation and this new humanity because he is no longer dead. And we believe that in time there was a person that was crucified, and as I say, that there's very few people argue with that. What some people do argue about is the resurrection. And so you have to ask yourself, if there was no resurrection, why are we here? Why did all this happen? It would have frittered out. There is no human philosophy that has lasted that is built on complete and utter lies. If the disciples that witnessed the resurrection, you know, did not believe this, why would they have been killed? Why would they have written what they have written? Why does somebody like Paul, who's a Jew, 30 years after the death of Jesus, write this? And the interesting thing is the style of this writing is completely different from the time. The gospel writings are completely strange for the time that they were written. C.S. Lewis said that it's either, you know, either the gospel writers were able to predict modern fiction and modern writing style in a way that no one else had, or what they have written must be true. Because it's not written in the way that legends were written in that time. And so Jesus demonstrates his supremacy in creation, but he also demonstrates his supremacy over death. And here's the thing, if you're going to be rescued, if you're going to be rescued from death, who do you need to rescue you? You need somebody that's actually been through it, done it, and got there, and knows what he's about. And so he is supreme in creation, he's supreme in the church, and finally, he is supreme in the ultimate or final creation. You see, this new people that have been made, this church in Colossae, this church here in Falkirk, my church in here, we have been made alive. We have been born out of the resurrection. You see, Jesus' resurrection, his death and his resurrection, it reverses the curse of sin and he makes everything new. In Genesis, a curse is pronounced that we will all die, that childbirth will be difficult, and that the earth will be a nightmare. And the Bible gets it right. Written by a guy called Moses, who knew nothing about these sorts of things. But somewhere out of nowhere, he is able to predict three certainties of humanity that do not go away. We all die, childbirth is difficult, and the world groans, and the world is cursed. And in Romans 8, we read that the creation has been groaning and is subjected to futility because of sin's curse. Sometimes Christians seem to think that sin's curse is only to do with them. It's to do with the whole thing. That's why the world is a state. That's why there's natural disasters. That's why there's wars. That's why the whole thing continues to break down despite people's best efforts. It is cursed. It is the consequences of sin. It is the curse that God pronounced in Genesis chapter 3. But it is not left there, because with the curse came the promise of the seed of the woman that would come. And so Jesus comes, the image of God, the firstborn from among the dead, and he undoes what is done by sin's curse. Death is defeated, the curse is reversed, and eventually he will reconcile all things, whether things in heaven and in earth, and they will be made new. And how does he do this? He does it through his blood shed on the cross and his resurrection. You see, the blood, the sacrifice, reverses the curse. It destroys the power of sin and death, and his resurrection is testament to the fact that the curse has been destroyed. And it shows you how bad sin was and how significant this curse was that it took the Son of God to reverse it. It wasn't just a case of God saying, oh well, no problem, we'll just give them a pass in that one. God in his righteousness and his justice and his holiness had to find a way that he could be just and righteous and holy, but also be the one that could forgive. And he does it in the person of his Son. And Romans says, both the one that makes men righteous and the one that is righteous, he does it all together in the person of his Son. And Jesus is the firstborn from among the dead, and the curse is reversed, and he will make all things new, ultimately at the end of time. Listen to these verses. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said this, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children." See, in the Garden of Eden, we have this picture of humanity and God in partnership, in relationship, enjoying one another. And that is broken apart by sin's curse. And at the end of the Bible, we see that being completely restored. God being part with us, us walking with God, us being his children, and him being our God, and us enjoying eternity with him. So Paul has prayed for this little church, and he has thanked for the gospel expression in the community, for the rescue they have received. And he said, "Here's the one that's rescued you. It's none other than the very Son of God, the image of God, the firstborn, the agent of creation, the sustainer of creation, the head of the church, the beginning of the church, the firstborn from among the dead, the one who is supreme over everything, the one to whom history belongs." And how is it possible? How is that possible? Well, we read this in verse 19. "For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him." All his fullness. His glory, his wisdom, his goodness, his grace, his power. Everything about God is poured into the person of his Son, who comes and walks among humanity. The one who does nothing except what the Father asks him to do. The one who comes because there was no other way to bring us back. There was no other way to restore us than for God to come down himself in the person of his Son. To humble himself to that extent. And yet shows his power over creation, sin and death, and reverses the curse. And says, "Follow me." As you look at the person of Jesus this morning, he would say to you, "Trust me." Not because he's a politician, but because he is the Son of God. And he is beyond our comprehension. He's beyond anything we can ever imagine or measure. People go on about the Big Bang. He was the one that said bang. He is the one that said, "Let there be light." And yet the irony of all this is that he goes to the cross. And you see, the cross, Jesus' death by crucifixion, is the heart of the gospel. And the cross is all about giving up power. It's not about winning power. It's about giving up power. And laying aside majesty. Do you see the love of God for you? Do you see how much God cares for you? That he came in the person of his Son. Before Jesus went to the cross, he was standing before the priests. And the high priest said something to him, and Jesus did not respond, and one of the guards slaps Jesus and says, "Who do you think you are? Do you not understand the high priest is speaking to you?" How ironic, because Jesus was the high priest, not some man-made high priest. He was the high priest. We sit here today because God gives us breath. We sit here today because God has given us life. you want to trust someone, if you want to place your faith in someone, then you trust someone who has made all things, who holds all things together, who has died and now lives, and one day will make everything new. That is the person to put your trust in. That is the person to believe. Someone who loves you to the extent to come down from the glories of heaven, to live your life and die your death so that you can be redeemed. Let's pray. Father, the knowledge of you is, as David said in one of his Psalms, too wonderful, too lofty for me to attain. It can be overwhelming and overpowering when we think about the level of power and awesomeness that you have. And sometimes we are glib when we think about you, and the world is glib when they disparage you and ignore you. And yet we thank you that you again and again and again have given people second, third and fourth chances, and that ultimately you cursed this earth, but you promised redemption at the same time, and you sent your son and you undid the curse, and that curse is being undone, and one day it will be completely reversed and there will be a new heaven and a new earth with a new humanity living in perfect harmony with you as their God. And there will be no more sickness, no more crying, no more aging, no more war, no more famine, no more badness. Just perfect peace and harmony with you. We thank you for the work of your Son, our Saviour, who is supreme in all things. Help us to acknowledge him and live our life for him as we seek to grow in knowledge and wisdom of you. For I ask this in his alone and worthy name.